the instruments, the tools, that we adopt as a result of those categories, in turn, begin dictating how we think and what we think, how we analyze. Now, let me give an example, which isn't meant to be personal, and that's addressed to any particular individual, but one sees it again and again. There's a real risk that the better you become in manipulating certain kinds of languages and certain kinds of tools, especially if I'm talking about alien modes of thought, alien institutions, that the more entangled one becomes in them, the thing that becomes useful to you, I'm speaking you now as though I'm addressing a native person, can carry you away. And what may begin as a game, so to speak, you know, I can use this to beat the other guy at his thing, that game can itself become an end in itself without one's being half aware of it. So if the end in view is how to best serve the interests of the people involved, and that has been said again and again, and if the end in view is securing the consent of those people, I think that carries certain implications for what one tries to do and how one goes about trying to do it. It sounds to me as though one would wish to have, wherever possible, modest means and gentle procedures that fit better with the variety of human types and that has more respect for their vulnerability. At any rate, that one shouldn't act in such a way that closes off the future of a very old and diverse people. Things that seem so important today may not seem so important later on. If you talk about people who've been around for thousands of years, you know, I mean, granted, to see 50 years into the future takes an immense act, and you know, and who knows what it'll be. But I'm more concerned about acting in ways that don't leave sufficient flexibility for that very old and diverse people to change its sense of what's important to us now, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. So I'm really talking about governance, and I'm going to be more specific in a minute. So in thinking about what governance is to use, surely use all the means that are appropriate, but because they meet the needs of the people first and foremost, rather than because they establish a doctrine, they establish a principle. And when I say that, I add immediately, without at any point disregarding the implications for the principles of following one way or the other, those implicit principles. Now, let me speak more particularly about considerations on choosing governmental forms. Mr. Pipestem said, government isn't fun. Self-governance isn't fun. In Chicago, they would say, politics ain't pushpin. And what wasn't said, but which is, I suppose, more or less a fact of life here as anywhere else, the lawless among us hate government. But in listening to the accounts of village political life, the multiplicity of layers of government and those poor, wretched 10 people with their 28 offices and so on being driven from pillar to post, I must say, I found that exhilarating. I thought, for God's sakes, if you're looking around to find what that original American looks like, I'm not talking about a native person, I mean in the political sense, the original American, your ur-revolutionary American, he's sitting right here in Alaska. That's the old ideal that Jefferson was talking about, of a people legislating for itself in a way that was visible to the governed, where there was publicity, where there was accountability on matters that came closest to those that were concerned. That's the purest form of self-government that there is. In contrast to the kind of governance that everyone is familiar with, and the people in Alaska not least of all, governance by clerks, governance by lawyers, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about natives or non-natives. It's not sweeter because it's one of your own. This multiplicity of tasks and bodies, it's not just a case of needless bureaucratization, though doubtless that's there. You know, if you looked at a history of the New England township in the 17th century and the 18th century, the smallest township had 17 different offices. There was an office of a hog reeve, a guy who was responsible for keeping pigs from running wild and rooting up other guys' gardens. And someone said, I think very truly, with the demand for services come demands on time and energy. You want less, you'll have less government. You want more, you got to pay for it. Moreover, this was another point that was raised. There are kinds of problems that have to be dealt with at different layers of government. I'm not even talking now about the state of Alaska or the government of the United States. Look, in Chicago, let's say you have, in the region, you've got 8 million people sitting around cheek by jowl. I'm speaking of the region. Maybe 120 or 200 different municipalities. You can't have a situation where one fellow flushes his waste down the other guy's well. Okay? And to deal with it is beyond the capacity of any one municipality. They have a metropolitan sanitary district, an immense engineering project, just trying to deal with sewage for 8 million people. And that simply overrides all these different little political jurisdictions. In New York, you have a Port of New York Authority. You've got 10, 12, 15 million people moving in and out. There's got to be some way of moving those bodies without regard to whether it's New Jersey or New York or Connecticut or whatever. So fisheries has something of that character, and caribou may have. And that suggests that whether you're dealing with these kinds of problems that simply are spread over an area larger than any jurisdiction, or whether you're dealing with opposite numbers that are larger than any jurisdiction can deal with, let's say a multinational conglomerate, you've got to have a different scale. It's another layer of government. There's no getting around it. But if you're choosing among forms, among appropriate governmental forms and modes of governance, that, it seems to me, has got to be more than a question of costs and benefits, let's say as an economic consideration. People were talking about some of the problems involved in the union of political and economic powers. And it was mainly treated as a problem of bad economics. I look at it another way. When I hear of that kind of union where the same heads and the same hands are exercising political power and economic power, I think of company towns, like in Appalachia, coal mining towns where there's only one mill. And that's a prescription for tyranny. And there's no reason, I don't have any reason to assume that native peoples are nicer than people anywhere else. Now the choice that you have to make among governmental forms and so on is complicated by conflicting desires, obviously. Not only among the native peoples, but I think within individual natives. I don't know how to say this without sounding nasty, and I mean, there's no animus in this. The thing I hear that comes, and the thing I see that comes through as people speak is an immense sense of pride in who one is, and who one's people is, and has been, and so on. An immense sense of pride on the one hand, and a great sense of dependency on the other. One wants at one and the same time the support of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a trust relationship, and all that. And it's obviously more of this is involved in this than simply having the BIA as a conduit of a funnel through which you can get money. The trouble is, even if one thinks of it only as a convenient way of getting money, there's a real problem in being beholden. And all the anger in the world and all the brave speeches doesn't do away with that inner servitude, that sense that I'm not my own man. And this goes in any number of situations. I mean, universities now are, you know, I mean, they're overwhelmingly financed, even private universities, they're overwhelmingly financed by Uncle Sugar. I mean, if someone is playing the tune, how can you not pay the piper? I don't have any simple resolution for this. I only raise some suggestions or questions. Can one take pride, and again, recognizing the tremendous differences in vulnerability and sophistication and all the rest among the different native peoples, can one take pride in caring for the dependency of others? Can those native peoples who are in a position to care for their brothers do so, and in the same way be rejecting dependency for themselves? I don't know if that's clear. You know, if you look at that history that Mr. Johnson summarized in his report, you can, you know, give me a one-word characterization for the history of white Indian governmental relations. You know, everyone will have his own word. One that comes to my mind is fickleness. And, you know, and what's been given can be taken. And what was taken, I mean, how many times have you had termination? You know, these things are not forever. And that was one of the points I tried to make last March, though it wasn't altogether clear to me. The vulnerability of these exceptional arrangements. I know that the native peoples are an exceptional case. But one of the large facts of life is the changeableness, the volatility of these legislative, administrative, and judicial policies. How can one risk a people's very existence, their very survival on that? Now, the old Thomas Jefferson answer is that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. You can never rest. You can never secure it. You can do your best, but there are no easy nights. And the thought that I raised last time, and I'll conclude with it, is this. I know it runs counter to, you know, to things that, you know, that many lawyers have suggested. Someone said, use whatever comes to hand, and there's a lot to be said for that. But I would urge this consideration. Most of all, I would think about seeking the protections that others cannot deny you without denying themselves. It's a world of white man's law. Now, if the protections that you make use of are such that the only way to separate you and your protection is, in effect, to require that the majority be separated from its protection, that's no small hold on other people's care. And if there's something to it, then that suggests a greater regard for the value of the law's protection. That's the law now is something more than a mere tool, a mere device, which I can cunningly manipulate in order to get something out of it. But a real respect for the kind of protection that it can afford you and anyone else living under the laws of the United States. I think that's about all I had to say.
Yeah. Thanks, Ralph. Did you want to follow Sheldon, or do you want to wait till later? I was just wondering, Charles, if you wanted to comment on what Ralph said.
No, I felt those were fair comments, but I have no specific response.
Okay. Reed, what about you?
I guess I've spent most of my professional career disagreeing with the premises that Ralph is, I think, articulating. I have a few thoughts about it, Tom. I guess first off, I do think that Jefferson was living in a very different kind of society. I think in a sense tribal institutions have to be given the opportunity to develop differently than, let's say, 18th century Virginia did. I think that the I don't think it's particularly attractive, the kind of thing that Dave Case describes of 29 villagers running around on 10 different committees, and one of them's a state committee, and one's a federal committee, and one's a state municipality, and so on. I think it's too complicated. It's not. It'd be too complicated for me. I think government has gotten much more complicated than it was in 18th century Virginia. And I think if the task is to build a governmental institution that works, then I think that one has to craft one that at least to start with is simple, and is tied in with the traditional values of these people, which is obviously very different in their communities than the 18th century squires in Virginia. There is a danger in any kind of system with a federal trust relationship that it breeds or that it reinforces dependency. But there is an almost certain prospect, in my judgment, that without that kind of a system, in some ways, and I think you can do exactly what Charlie Wilkinson and others have been saying, you can pick and choose your the menu. You don't have to take everything on the menu. You can have meat and not potatoes. But I think that I think without some kind of protection like this, the prospect for having a culture overwhelmed by the incursions of a essentially resource-gathering society and resource-using society. I mean, there's never been a society in the history of the world that is as resource-exploitative as the Western industrial society. And we seem to be transmitting it to other parts of the world, and they seem to be acting that way. And that's, I think that's just a given. But I think without that kind of protection, I don't think that there's much chance for native culture to be able to resist and thrive. I think it may be able to. I think it's been immensely survivable. I mean, I'm much more likely to bet that it's here 10,000 years from now than that anything like Western industrial culture is here 10,000 years from now. I would bet on the native culture to be here. But I think to survive in the kind of onslaughts that it's going to face in the immediate future, I think it needs to take the chance on that, and I think that it's just very different. We're dealing with a very different kind of federal establishment now than we were dealing with even 20 years ago. I mean, I think again and again, those of us who've dealt with it, spent our professional lives dealing with it, have seen the changes year by year, the kind of thing Charles Wilkinson was able to persuade Senator Jackson's staff of things just a few years later that the ANCSA leaders were not able to persuade them of. So I think that the federal government is not an oppressive bureaucracy just now. I think it's possible it might be 20 years from now. I think it certainly was 20 years ago. And I think you do have to be vigilant on that if you're a native group or anyone else. But in terms of native affairs, what you really have now with Indian preference in the Bureau of Indian Affairs is you have an institution that is increasingly employs people from the group that it has some governmental authority over, and employs people who are increasingly sensitive to the needs and aspirations of Native people and Indian people to govern themselves. So it's a chance I would be prepared to take. I recognize it's a chance, but it's a chance I would be prepared to take, and I counsel clients every day to take, rather than run the risks of essentially being pulverized by an enormous market system that's being brought to bear on their resources and their subsistence. So I think Ralph's position is a welcome counsel. I mean, everyone should listen to it very carefully. It's one on balance that I differ with.
Yeah, Rosita has something to say, and then David Case. Maybe I could offer a comment as a Canadian on what Ralph said. Ralph said that political arrangements relating to Native people, certainly those championed here today, are exceptional arrangements. And he went on to indicate that he thought they were therefore vulnerable. Well, that's at the root of all this, I suppose. The cast of mind that regards tribal government as exceptional, something, as Browning Pipestem said yesterday, that doesn't altogether square with the ideas of liberal democracy, and so on. And in Canada, there are Canadians here, so I must be guarded in what I say, but the Penner Committee, which was an all-party committee of the House of Commons representing all three of Canada's national political parties, brought in a report last year urging that Native governments be accepted as a third order of government, that is, federal, provincial, and Native governments, and those would be the governments recognized under the Constitution. It would not be exceptional. It would be part of the accepted arrangements on which political structures are built. At any rate, that may be that something that indicates how public attitudes can evolve and change. But I certainly think that if you stop people on the streets of the United States and ask them about what Ralph Lerner had said, you would find an awful lot of them would buy it, and it's a question, I think, of acceptance of what of the legitimacy of indigenous ideas of political authority. Well, that's all pretty difficult stuff. Rosita and David, you wanted 10 children.
Well, I just wanted to thank Ralph for answering my question, not directly, but perhaps I think in his discussion really, I guess, responding to the question that I had raised in what is the basic difference or what is the conflict between tribal law, and when I say tribal law, I don't mean the things that have been codified in statutes, but actually the customary laws, the traditional norms, and the values of Native people. What is the difference between Native laws and Western laws? And as Ralph was talking, it reminded me of an incident that happened between the U.S. Navy or a U.S. naval officer and one of my grandfathers, whose name was Stuaka. And one of my grandfathers took Lieutenant Schwatka, and for those of you who know anything about Alaska history, Lieutenant Schwatka was a naval officer who came from the coast and traveled inland into Canada. And he hired some Tlingit people to work for him and to carry things over the Chilkoot Pass. And they were both operating within their own cultural framework, their own cultural values, and their own economics. And Lieutenant Schwatka paid my grandfather X amount of dollars. And my grandfather thought, well, this wasn't enough. And so he took Lieutenant Schwatka's name. And thereafter, he became known as Schwatki, which in Tlingit is the EE is possessive, my Schwatka. And among the Tlingits, that's the worst thing that you could do to someone is take a name away, because name is property. But on the other hand, Lieutenant Schwatka and others assumed that Schwatki was honoring this great explorer. And so each went along happily in their own merry way. But unfortunately, more often we see that the conflicts between the two systems are very real and probably have greater ramifications in terms of really, concrete things happening to people. And I think what you said, what can be given, can be taken away, really speaks to the differences between the two cultural systems as I see them, or one of the major significant differences. And that is, in Native societies, the values are always taught that you should share, that you should give away. And in the end, you have reciprocity. In the end, those who have more get something in return. And so it's a direct conflict with the other values of accumulating surplus. So I think it just, thank you for illuminating in that difference.
Well, thank you, Rosita. That was well put, very well, I think. David Case, sorry.
I have some questions I want to ask Fred Harhoff. And unfortunately, this is not the right way to do it, because as a lawyer, you're supposed to only ask questions when you know the answer, and I don't know the answers to these questions. We've heard a good deal, and Ralph was really alluding to it just now, of the complexity, and I would say, as described, the necessary complexity of government. And I'm not sure if complexity is the right word, but levels of government. And Bill Dubé alluded to this, if not here, at least in private, to if you're going to have all of these services, if you're going to have services in villages, you've got to have numbers of government representatives, agencies, ways to interact, and so forth. So my question is about Greenland. How complex is government in Greenland? And you do have village. There are villages, I think, in Greenland. Is that correct? And there's a central kind of government also in the home rule government. Is that correct? For the record, he nodded yes. I want to know. What is government like in Greenland villages? Is it as you heard it described here, or is it, do you have that multiplicity of people, offices, institutions in order to deliver services, or don't you?
Well, if you go to the very local level, then I guess it is limited what you would find of government at all. I mean, I've been to a lot of settlements where you won't see anything at all.
Well, go ahead. How do people live there? I mean, what sort of services do they have? What do they have? Electricity? Do they have homes? What is it?
Yeah. Well, a normal small settlement along Greenland's coast would be one of, let's say, between 50 or 100 persons living in houses. There would be a small power plant providing for electricity. There would be local fishing from either small trawlers or, more likely, small boats with, you know, an outboard motor. And there would be, to a certain extent, maybe a freezing plant to collect the catch that is taken in the surrounding waters. And there might be a nurse living there, you know, doing whatever she could do of providing for health and medical care. And that's about it. A local school teacher will be living in one of the houses and having, probably educating the kids in his own house.
Who regulates, directs the nurse, the school teacher, the power plant operator, the fishing enterprise? Is there a council? Is there a what?
There are local village councils, I should say. Well, it's not very formally done, you know. They could just go together and they cooperate as to the tasks that are to be undertaken. Well, if you look at the power plant, for instance, there would be a mechanic, skilled guy who would be able to repair it when it goes to pieces. And this man, of course, he will be paid by the Home Rule government. So he's an employee.
He's paid by the Home Rule government?
Yeah.
How does the money get to him? I mean, does it come from an agency of the Home Rule government, or does it come to the council of the community?
That would be paid by the municipal authority.
Council.
Right. Regional municipal authority.
Oh, there's a regional municipal authority, yep. Then, too.
Yeah. Am I satisfying your...
Well, I guess what I would... I don't want to take up too much time with all of this, but I'm interested to know if it is possible someplace to have government that, as I naively assume, can be simpler than it appears to be in villages in Alaska.
Well, I think that the main picture that is to be seen in Greenland is that of there are, of course, tasks that are most adequately dealt with on a very, very local level, right? And these are being dealt with in the local, in these village councils. They have no decisive influence. They are just advisory bodies, so to say. Mm-hmm. And then each region, you know, consisting of, there would be one city, for instance, which would be the center of the region, and then a number of villages around, or settlements around. And at this level, you would find, so to say, the regional planning level. And this is obvious that a task of this character is most adequately dealt on a regional basis. And then on top of it, you have the Home Rule government, which sets out all the laws and the acts providing for this business. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you take it, there is a need for a general overall planning of the fishery. Well, that is being dealt with on the main level. And this may provide for regional arrangements. Okay, this will be dealt with on the municipal regional level, and then carried out in the village level. And as far as the main conflicts between Greenland and Denmark are concerned, then you would find that the Home Rule government, as such, is the body which takes the fight, so to say, with the Danes, with the Danish government.
Okay.
But I could return to this.
Ralph wants to say something, but I guess I can understand how government in Chicago with millions of people and in New York and a large municipality can require many, many layers and boards and agencies and so forth in order to operate it. And I can understand in the North Slope borough how with large assets and huge construction projects and many construction projects, and that you have to have many layers of government. I don't understand, and I still, why in a community of 50 to 200 people, government has to be so damn complex. That's all.
Well, that's rhetorical. I think, yeah. Ralph...
I don't know that it has to be that complex at all. All I'm saying is that we've heard again and again of situations where something happens 500 or 1,000 miles away and it has all sorts of important repercussions for a village. It's not something that they see on the horizon. It's way over there somewhere, which affects caribou or which affects the fish that they fish for, feed on, or whatever. So there are problems that simply are beyond the capacity of a given locality, which means that you have to multiply. When I don't want to be understood as urging, you know, a single mode for anyone. I'm not urging any mode. I'm only suggesting that nobody can care as much about the interests of a particular native people as those people can. And that means, to the extent that they are able to keep things in their hands, in their care, they stand a better chance of caring for them. It's not just a native government issue. We live in a time of immense, overwhelming pressure for homogenization, for uniformity, and for centralization. It's not just that you go ask your average fellow on the street in Chicago about tribal government, you know, and he wants to throw up on you. It's not just that. We have political units of much greater popular acceptance in American history than tribal government that have been reduced to nothingness. When I was a kid, people used to talk about states' rights. You know, I'm not talking about the 18th century. And for all practical purposes, the states are what passes for federalism in the United States is a simple client relationship. They pass money on. But they're out there with their little tin cup in Washington, just like any other bunch of petitioners. Leaving aside the special wrinkles, quote Indian engenders in the average mind. These are forces that are much larger and not limited to native governance. There's a real problem in how you speak to people, you know, given that kind of situation.
Charles, did you want to add something?
There are other people who are anxious. I'll pass for the moment.
Sheldon?
Thank you. As everybody said here earlier, I would like to thank everybody that has taken the time and the effort and the sacrifice to help us grapple with this very real problem, which primarily, as I have to keep bringing this up, is primarily, who are we talking about? Are we talking about Alaska's non-natives? Are we talking about America's people? You got to keep your perspective. And I think that the perspective that is most important is you have to put yourself in the mukluks of our native people here in Alaska. We are on the verge, if nothing is done, we are on the verge of extinction in every sense of the word. If in fact we become a part of the Western society and their cash economy, are we not then Western and cash economized? Yesterday and over these last 4 days, I've been trying to make the point that what we are faced with as Native people is legislative genocide. And there has been not a rebuttal from anyone that that is in fact the case. Why? That scares the hell out of me. Not a person here, and you all profess to know the law, nary a person here stood up and said that this is not true, the American people are not like this. You accept it like it's an everyday occurrence in America, that your government has a power and the acceptance of its people to go around and extinguishing not just the government, not just their land base, but a people. And not just any people, but the people that originally were here. What kind of moral right is that? That a people can accept, and not only accept, but in the name of such things as, quote, constitutional rights, individual constitutional rights, we can wipe out this traditional tribal government that's been here since time immemorial. I think what we are faced with is jealousy. I have said it before and I'll say it again. Alaska's native people are the freest people on this earth. And I'll tell you why. We are not dependent on the cash economy. If I was dependent on the cash economy like the rest of the United States, and I knew that my government owed $2 trillion, I'd be awful worried. We can live in harmony with our land. Our land, as long as we respect it, will respect us. Is that too hard to accept? Why do you have to destroy not just our government, but our land base and the food on which we rely? Why must you regulate our living? And that is what we do. As I mentioned earlier, fish and game are not fish and game to us. There is no sport involved. It's survival. We do not ask to regulate your food. Why must you impose your regulations of our food? Genocide, serious terms. What does that mean? That means a killing off of an entire race. We thought that went out with World War II. I never ever thought that I would ever feel so threatened that I must ask for protection from genocide. America, land of the free, home of the brave. A lot of talk has been made about the highest moral imperative. But then you feel that if you pay lip service to the highest moral imperative without even recommending something to do something about it, you're forgetting my point. We are asking for restoration to all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities which we as tribes have, not just to you and your government, but to our people and our governments. Our tribal governments have been sorely damaged. I've been making this point. Why must you insist that there has to be state of Alaska jurisdiction over Alaska's natives? Paper conquest. I think our native people would feel a lot better if you would just go about it and declare war. Eventually, there'd be a war settlement, would there not? Maybe we'll end up another Japan, an economic giant as a result of the American guilt trip. The non-native can afford tunnel vision with regard to his life. He can afford to specialize. I am a lawyer. Forget the rest. Everything else is in place. My government is secure. My services are provided. It's a government of the people, by the lawyers, for the multinational corporations. And the sooner that you realize that, the sooner that